So welcome back. How was were you able to practice while you were out in the environment, outer environment? Did anybody notice any palpable difference from being here and looking inwardly to then going out into the outer world, inner world to outer world? Yeah, what did you know? We need a mic. Sorry.
I
Thanks,
had that
Amy.
they sort of, instead of feeling calmer, I noticed like I way overate at lunch. And I was like, for some reason, I was like really agitated in a way that, and like overeating is something I do when I'm like, when I have sort of underlying like something that I'm stuffing down. And
Oh.
like I didn't, but yeah, so instead of like feeling all peaceful, I like ate way more than I should have. And I don't know why, like, whatever we did stirred something for me.
Well, we made more space for food, I think. We created more internal space, so there was room to fill. Yeah, well, you know about the second arrow? Sure, yeah. So there's a teaching on it's the Salata Sutta on the teaching on the second arrow is, I'm going to paraphrase it, okay? We get shot with an arrow, it hurts. And instead of pulling it out, you know, this is a story of someone that this happened to long ago, and, you know. But so I'll make it more contemporary. Instead of pulling the arrow out, it hurts like heck, and we're kind of dying. We want to know, oh, who shot the goddamn arrow? And where did they get the feathers that went on the arrow? And I wonder what kind of wood that was made out of. And can I then pull it out and then get that person with it? You know, and so what we do is we create suffering on top of pain. We add to, we create a bigger story or a story around whatever it is that we're experiencing, and then that's the second arrow. So it's like pouring, to use more of an American phrase, pouring salt on the wound. And it's really interesting when we start to notice how often we do that. So part of mindfulness and part of, you know, meditation practice is noticing things as they are. Period. And part of the way our mind works is to put a dot, dot, dot. You know, there's no period. It's and then if, and then I wonder, and then huh, and then it did, and then it might. You know, we do all those proliferations. So those are the many arrows. Yeah. And I have to say also that, you know, we have to learn our lessons over and over and over again. We hit our head on a wall until we don't anymore. And every time we hit our head on a wall, it just helps us to wake up a little bit and maybe not do it again. But if we do, we forgive ourselves. Because it's, you know, it just takes a while to undo some certain habits. It takes a while. And so that's why in the beginning of our day today, I mentioned the kindness factor. You know, to me, that's the biggest practice. And actually, the Dalai Lama says his main practice is kindness, or his religion is kindness, is what he said. My religion is kindness. And it takes practice out of the conceptual into the malleable. Kindness makes things more malleable. Kindness makes things okay. Kindness makes a mistake okay. Kindness allows us to get up and try again, to not be perfect, to try, to hold our own hands and say, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. You know, that's kindness. So we, or that's aspects of kindness. And it's also aspects of generosity. So compassion, kindness, metta, karuna, dana, generosity, are all really fundamental foundations of a meditation or any kind of spiritual practice that we tend to forget about, but they're the key ingredients to anything that we're going to practice. Because if it's just conceptual and we judge ourselves, then things don't go so well. So checking our expectations, being okay with not being exactly as we want to be right yet. And actually, my favorite word in English is yet. I use that one on myself all the time. Not yet. So feel free to add that to whatever you say to yourself. I didn't do that yet. I have a great quote here. I never memorize quotes. I don't have the mind that memorizes quotes. And I'm always in awe of people that have, you know, the mind to recite Shakespeare or some really smart quote. I don't judge myself anymore, but I say it out loud so you won't judge me. In case you are. This is a quote by Joyce Carol Oates. She says, "Self-criticism is an art form not many are qualified to practice." So let's just stop trying that one. And this one I found recently. You know, I used to watch Charlie Brown when I was younger and got a lot out of it. And then kind of forgot about Charlie Brown until yesterday when I ran across this little cartoon of Charlie saying, "My anxieties have anxieties." That's the second arrow. So we all have a little bit of Charlie Brown and what were the other guys in there? Pigpen and Lionel, all those wonderful, Lucy, give advice for, you know, 5 cents or 1 cent, whatever she charged. Yeah. Anybody else have an experience after lunch to share? It's good to share because then we know we're not in this alone. Yeah.
I actually got a call from my 13-year-old daughter who's in an art class right now preparing for high school and, you know, always resisting the overbearing mother in this whole process. And I found myself in this conversation sharing my experience and how it related to what she was going through in the class. And it was good.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's how we grow collectively. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Instead of reacting.
Oh, yeah. That's so important. You know, on so many levels, I don't have children, so I can't relate except for just sort of through my imagination how wonderful that is. I had a great mom. I was really lucky about that. But I do know about, you know, through my own experience of teaching especially and just being in the world, you know, as long as I have been, that whatever we're doing with our own mind, heart, body, you know, whatever we're practicing or what our intentions are, just how we're living, how we're being, you know, just how we are in the world does affect others, and we grow maybe slowly together, but we grow, you know, collectively. Paradigms shift, consciousness opens more and more, you know. And when you can even make that palpable, like you just did with your daughter, then that encourages her in a way through your vulnerability and your transparency that maybe you didn't get from, you know, your mom or dad, not because they didn't know, but because they didn't have the same tools, you know. So that's really lovely. It's okay to have these experiences and feelings that we have. And the more, you know, I don't know that we need to wear it all on our sleeves all the time. It can be a little bit TMI, but certainly sharing important experience and vulnerabilities, I think, is really important. Really important. Anyone else? Okay. I want to just tell you, you know, the title of this workshop is Anxiety, It's Not All in Your Mind. And in part of the description, I mentioned how, you know, anxiety can be caused by a lot of different factors. But how many of you think that you're to blame for your anxiety? Or do you feel that you create it? You control it, you create it? Yeah. I mean, most of us feel that way. Most people feel that way. But let me just tell you some of the things that can create anxiety without us really knowing, and knowing that this is where it's coming from. And then we take the blame for it. Like, did you know that, well, we know that the repetitive and ruminative thoughts can create anxiety. We know that, right? And usually in a mindfulness or a meditation workshop or day long or something like this, you know, we're reminded that we can pay attention to our thoughts, that we can work with our own thoughts, that we work with our feelings, that we feel the feelings, we work with them, that we move more towards them and experience them than push them away, you know. And there was that example from the carpenter of poking out the bigger peg with a smaller peg, replacing something unskillful, unpleasant with something that's beautiful or pleasant, yeah? And we also talk about what creates anxiety, and it's very important to mine our own history, our story, and to see, well, maybe it started here, maybe it started there. That's very important. But at the same time, it's important to know that things like gut imbalances can create anxiety or cause anxiety. Lack of estrogen or testosterone. You know, certainly women know about that, and men maybe don't know about the testosterone so much unless you get tested. Adrenal fatigue can create anxiety. Overproduction of insulin, if you're diabetic or even close to diabetic. Hyper or hypothyroid. Trauma and PTSD, we know that one. Illnesses, surgeries. Genetics play a part for some of us. We can inherit anxiety. Now, some of that is behavioral, but some of it might be genetic. It's thought to be genetic. And you know, what's a big one is culturally inherited trauma. And then I want to add to that the state of the world that we're in right now with the climate crisis, with our political crisis, with the way the world is right now. It's not exactly pleasant. And we know about it. That's a big difference because we have so much access available, you know, in our handheld devices, that we generally are not taking very much time away from hearing the latest bad news. And that really plays a role in anxiety. So you want to remember that. Now, so we might feel even just anxiety, you know, anxiety just from being where we are in history right now. And so it's important that we don't assign too easily, which we do normally, assign blame for anxiety to ourselves. We didn't necessarily cause it, and we're not necessarily keeping it going, and we're not to blame. So, you know, a little forgiveness, which we'll do a bit of, and kindness is really helpful. But we can take, on the other hand, and see if this fits for you simultaneously. We may not be to blame, and usually we're not, but we can do something about it and take responsibility. So blame and responsibility can be two different things. Can you feel that? So let's say you inherit, or you have a physical condition that creates anxiety. I mean, I know anxiety firsthand from thyroid issues. My first panic attack was here in New York in the middle of a street. But so I knew that this was not caused by my mind. I knew this was, it was out of the blue. It was completely different than anything I had ever experienced. I was frozen, so I got that whole range of experience, you know, that some of you might have a lot. I got it. And so I didn't feel I was to blame for it, which was good because I'd been practicing long enough to know that that was not something that I had just caused. But I did take responsibility and work with myself around it. So there were a bunch of practices like what we're doing today that I did even more of to keep that from coming back too often. But it wasn't until my thyroid was under control that it really ceased. So we can be responsible for what is going on right now, but responsibility doesn't mean, A, that we can completely eradicate it or change it. It means that we're going to try. And B, we don't need to add that second, third, fourth, fifth, whatever arrow it is of blame. Okay? Because you might have something, you know, it might be just from where the world is right now and you're reading too much news or you're too involved with politics. Because, I mean, that'll drive anybody into an anxious state right now. So, you know, these are things that we can say, okay, well, what can I do about that? A, B, C, I can take these steps. So I want to name that because the blame, the shame, the repetitive criticism keeps it going. Because if you feel blame, if you blame yourself, if you shame yourself, you feel ashamed for what's going on inside of you. If you criticize yourself, what does that do to your body, your heart, and mind? Like if you could use your hands, what would it look like? Yeah, there's somebody doing this. Yeah, what else? What else would it look like? How about like, you know, it wouldn't be like this, right? This would be the opposite. So this is why we work with the body, because the more spaciousness and softness that we procure in our bodies, this somatically it starts to ripple into mind, heart. I want to venture in now to a territory called the subtle body. Are you all familiar? Any of you familiar with the subtle body? So the subtle body is the unseen body. Have you ever, you might be somewhat familiar with acupuncture and how acupuncture works. So acupuncture is based on a meridian system. And the meridian system, if you were to look at a chart of the meridians in the body, you would see what look like rivers or streams or just lines, like a map, like a road map, basically. And it runs all over the body. And if you've ever done acupuncture, they'll put a little tiny needle in, let's say, your wrist, and you feel that in your shoulder. Or they put a little needle in your foot, and you feel that in your gut. You think, huh, how's that connected? The mystery is how anybody figured all these things out. I think that's fascinating. But people have. And it is a long tradition, thousands of years old, that started in China. The meridian system is part of what's called the subtle body. It's not seen. but you can definitely sense it. And this is the basis of Chinese acupuncture and acupressure. It's also very similar to what are called bindus and nadis, which are different kinds of energetic lines and points in the tantric yogic system from India, and also in the tantric system of Tibet. And so each of these systems have slight variations on the theme of subtle body. Like, you might have heard of chakras, right? That's probably the most widely known form of working with the energy or the energetic system or the subtle body system. And, you know, even the chakra system varies slightly from one culture or tradition to another. So the thing is that there are a lot of ways to approach it. And that's, for me, I think that's reason to just pause for a moment, because that means there's not just one way to experience the subtle body. There's not just one way to experience the energy systems or the centers, energetic centers of the body. There's a couple of few, probably many ways. And so we don't want to necessarily adhere to one system and say this is the right way and another is the wrong way. But what we would like to do, I think, is experience them for ourselves. And so the subtle body, again, is the unseen body. It's the felt body. It's what we feel. It's also very closely connected to the nervous system. The nervous system isn't seen necessarily, but it's definitely felt, okay? Now, most closely, I relate what I feel, what I've experienced, to the Tibetan system. Not because I learned it, but because I had all these experiences, especially on long retreats. And then when I did a lot of work, internal work, through the subtle body and the energetic system, my own energetic system, and then met my first Tibetan teacher, Sokni Rinpoche, and he asked me a bunch of questions and asked me how I healed from my first illness, and I told him, and asked me to describe what I did internally, and I told him, and he said, "Oh, that's bliss." I was like, "Really?" He said, "Oh, yes, yes, you have to teach that." And I was like, He said, "It's just the mind. Ha, 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 ha. It's just consciousness. Ha, ha, teach it." And I do a little. When you mention subtle body and Tibetan Tantra, you can sometimes invite a different kind of crowd. Which I have done by accident early on, not knowing that. Experience is our greatest teacher. So I started to look at some of the writings and the descriptions of the Tibetan medical system especially. And what I came to find out was there were a lot of the experiences and the things that they would describe in healing systems, in their medical system, in their diagnostic system, and in the imagery that came along with it. So the Tibetans use a lot of visual imagery, was what I had experienced myself on retreat, you know, before I ever knew about it. And that was such a great relief, because I thought, you know, I mean, I am an artist and I make a lot of things up, but I didn't make that up. What I did was I tapped in. And so when we meditate, one of the things that's so interesting about meditation is that when you open your mind, you're like a homing device. And you read, you pull, you gather, you hear, you experience wisdom, consciousness from all sorts of places and forms, sources, we don't know where, you know, but you open to. And so I felt great that I hadn't made this up, but I had tapped in, because that's an empowering thought, isn't it? That we can tap into larger consciousness and awareness. And it's part of really knowing interdependence, and that's then part of where compassion springs. So I want to describe to you, in my, you know, from my own experiences and my little bit of knowledge of the Tibetan system, how this might work and why it relates to anxiety. Oops, I'm going to move over here. Is that okay? I'm the movable. Okay, how's that? Fantastic. Okay, so don't laugh at my drawing. It's not meant to be anatomically correct, okay? Okay. So when we feel, I asked you this in the this morning, when you feel anxiety, typically where is your breath? Kind of up high, yeah? So the Tibetans think of the energetic system in terms of wind. And I like that because I think, you know, metaphors of nature are really helpful. So when we experience something like anxiety, if we can imagine, the winds of the body have been kicked up, right? So it feels like up here, or even up here, right? Now, if anxiety were a wind, what kind of wind would that be?
Biting.
A biting wind?
Yeah. Is that what you said? Biting.
Sharp biting.
Still?
Stormy, yeah. It would be stormy. It's certainly not calm breeze, is it? Mm-hmm. Right? So if the winds are kicked up with anxiety, which is what happens, and remember, wind, when we talk about wind, we're talking about energy. When we talk about energy, we're talking about the mind. We're talking about consciousness, okay? Those are all this kind of the same thing. The Chinese talk about it in terms of qi, all right? So wind in Tibetan is lung. Energy from more of the Chinese tradition is qi.
What did you say, lung?
Lung. It's L-O-O-N-G-E. And sometimes it's spelled L-U-N-G-E. Lung. And they have lung pa, yeah. So it means wind. So when we're anxious, we're up here. It's like the wind has gotten kicked up, or it even is in here. And it starts to go a little out here. There's nothing happening down here, very little, right? And it's almost like this. There's a little central channel. Let's just assume there is anyway. I'm going to ask you to go on a little belief here. There's a central channel that goes there and there. You know, who says where the beginning or the end is? It really doesn't matter because different systems describe it differently. But basically what happens is that everything gets squeezed in this way. Down here, everything gets tight, and then it kind of explodes and implodes up here. All right? So a lot of the diagnosis is where the winds of the body are, because where the winds are tells you what imbalances there are in the internal system. But it's consciousness, okay? So remember, winds are mind. And so the Tibetans work with the mind to settle the winds, plus herbs, you know, massage, different kinds of breathing exercises, different yoga practices. But they're more internally based, to work with, to settle the winds, or to move the winds in a place where they need to go to be more balanced, okay? I think that's really interesting, because what happens when the winds are kicked up is is that there's not a whole lot going on down here, which means there's not a whole lot going on down here. So we've lost touch with the earth. We're not grounded anymore. We're groundless. And when we're groundless, we don't feel very relaxed, at ease, at home, present, in our bodies at all. So literally, when we're grounded, which is what I was bringing us, you know, the things that we were doing this morning were to help you to feel, at least for a few minutes, grounded. When you're grounded, your breath settles, your belly relaxes, your diaphragm is soft. When you're not grounded, everything lifts up high, and it's just this big storm. And once that storm gets kicked up, it's kind of hard to find your footing. So our aim is to find some balance in the wind. So you might remember that I suggested in the beginning of the day, that or this morning, that we imagine our breath like a breeze, right? And we start opening some windows somewhere. And then we also imagine the breath as a breeze coming in, and it was filling us in a 360-degree, more containerish type of way. So front to back, side to side. So, and then we were filling, it doesn't matter if it's top down or bottom up, really. We're filling up, and we're entering, or letting go, emptying out, and we're filling up, and we're emptying out and letting go. And you see how that's more balanced as far as distribution of wind or breath? So wind and breath are the same, or can be the same. And so when we have a little bit more of a balance and just even more control of the breath, we have more control of the mind. So Chökyi Nyima Rinpoche is the brother of a couple of the teachers of mine. And he says, when you control the breath, you control the mind. All the ancient yogis knew this. This is why there's so much pranayama practice. Pranayama is yoga of the breath. A little bit of that, we did that this morning. We're going to do a little bit more. You control the breath, you control the mind. That doesn't mean tight control. That's not holding on to that striker, you know, like this. It's being active and intentional, but not rigid and not tight. When we control the breath and we move it around, we're moving the wind, we're moving the mind. I call it moving the mind practice. Then the system is in better balance and in more harmony. And we actually feel our feet. So there's a number of ways to do that, but this is the essence of it. And so breath and wind, in essence, eventually, you might experience this at some point. I hope you do. And visualization can also help us with this, believe it or not. So if you have a good imagination, it's helpful. If you don't, I'll give you some suggestions. Kind of an interesting hairdo, so I'm going to leave that up. So breath, that's a little bit more even, that we're going to direct, we're going to try this, actually comes both ways. So when we breathe in, we're not making that happen, as you know. What's making that happen? It's gravity, right? Gravity presses breath in and down, and it pushes the diaphragm down, and that's what allows the lungs to fill up. So as the, I'm going to go all my little props here, as the breath is being pressed in and down, diaphragm goes down, the lungs are filling up, so it's going like this. This. And actually it's going in this direction too, but I don't have enough hands, right? So if somebody says, oops, that breath comes in through the top of the head. That you need to always practice the breath, imagining it coming from the top of the head down.
That's one way.
And if somebody says you need to imagine the breath coming in from the bottom and moving up,
that's another option. But literally, it's going both ways.
And because of these diaphragms that we have, one here, and believe it or not, one here, and I'm hoping to teach that one to you, literally what's happening is, see if this makes some visual sense to you. So this diaphragm goes down and it goes up when you breathe in. This diaphragm goes down and it breathes up when you go in. And this diaphragm goes down and it lifts up when you breathe out. So these diaphragms are always doing this. So you can see there's actual balance going on, just even energetically, up and down all the time. Now you can, so it doesn't matter which direction you imagine it to go. And I'll talk you through this so it's not just flat on a board. But this is all happening in the subtle body. And I think in particular, again, just to reinstate this, is in terms of anxiety, we can sort of get, maybe some of you have had the direct experience of the wind of anxiety, if there were such a wind. It's discursive and it's up here. It's like a big hurricane or a tornado or this huge, you know, thunder and lightning storm. It's definitely not calm. Well, now energetically, through the mind, with the mind, with consciousness, with energy, with breath, we can learn to balance that out. Now, it's not that you balance it out in the moment that it's heightened. That's really, really hard. You can, but that takes a long time to get to that place. What we can do is maintain balance before it happens, so that when it happens, it's not as long-lasting, it's not as devastating, and we know how to recover from it. Okay? Does that make sense? It's really hard to gather your balance when you've been knocked off, you know? But the longer you practice and the more you practice, longer and more, now I don't mean like hours and hours a day, but consistently for long periods of time, you know, like i.e. months and then years, then the more quickly you recover from everything, anything and everything. So of course you lose your balance. Of course you have emotions like everybody else. Some of them are still quite strong. But you only get knocked off for short periods of time, not for long periods. Before we practice, we can get knocked off for very long periods. And that's hard, because the recovery is also difficult. Okay? So there's tons of hope with these simple practices, but we have to do them. That's the thing. So you think about, irregardless of whether you feel that you've caused your anxiety or not, you can take responsibility and you can practice to work with it. Yeah? But it has to be consistent, because everything in our system is conditioned. We can decondition. Maybe not eradicate completely, but we can definitely decondition. And I know this firsthand, in a lot of different ways. And I'm sure there's some of you in the room that know it too, in your own ways. Okay? So...